So tonight, as Gil laid out for us last night, we're going to talk about the first noble truth tonight, as well as metta. And I actually, when we were sending around emails on who was going to talk about what, I wanted to talk about dukkha, because I actually love talking about dukkha. And I think that dukkha is really undersold and underrated. And I think part of it has to do with our societal aversion to suffering. And from how I've experienced dukkha and from my understanding of dukkha now through practice, it was never to scare us off or to be averse to, but it was really to have a deep understanding of, so that we could liberate ourselves from the delusion, from the confusion, and all those things that cause suffering. So why I love teaching it so much is because I feel like I've had some direct experience with dukkha. I've lived with a lot of dukkha, as I'm sure many of you have also. And realizing that no amount of running or hiding or distracting or numbing or covering up can free us. It's not until we actually directly stand under dukkha, as Ajahn Sumedho says. Stand under, not just understand, but stand under dukkha, can we really liberate ourselves. And I think what we oftentimes try to do is to intellectually understand it. But the beauty of retreat and doing this practice is, as the days go by, and even today, as I saw people realizing in interview, is that the intellectual mind, the conceptual mind, isn't actually so helpful all the time. It's useful a lot of the time. It's a beautiful tool. It's necessary. We love the mind. We cherish the mind. And the mind can be a trap. It's very cunning. It loves to play games. And I have a cat named Loki. Loki is the Norse trickster god. You know, so our mind is like that. It loves to trick us and play with us. And especially, I find, when we're quiet. There's no better playground for the mind. We're no better victims for the mind than when we're still. The ultimate Mara playground, when we're still and when we're quiet. So I just want to talk about a few sort of, the way that dukkha is translated often is suffering, right? I'm sure you've heard that many times, suffering. And I think the word suffering in itself is somewhat complicated, and it automatically sort of elicits an aversion, I think, anyway. So there's a few different translations for it that I like a little better. They kind of reside in a subtler place, maybe. So Bhikkhu Anālayo, how he breaks it down is du meaning difficult or difficulty, and ka, he calls the whole of the ox cart. So imagine, we're talking 2,600 years ago, the Pali language, a wooden hole and a wooden pole and dirt roads. Bumpy dirt roads. So imagine that pole trying to roll around in that hole. And you're sitting on a cart and you're bouncing around a lot. Discomfort, right? A lot of disease, a lot of discomfort. It's not the very nice shock absorbers that we have on our cars now. The word would be translated much differently now. But so that was one, that's one way that he translates it, that bumpy friction, disharmony. You know, it's not a big deal. It's not a car crash, but it's just, it's discomfort. It's disease. It's not easy. Another way that he describes it is just uneasiness, not standing in an easy way. And then Bhikkhu Bodhi calls it just a basic unsatisfactoriness running through our lives. So oftentimes when we talk about or think about dukkha, I'm going to talk about the three ways that actually dukkha is described in the suttas. But oftentimes when we talk about dukkha, we want to think of big catastrophic things, right? So it's so easy to think, oh, dukkha is real suffering. Dukkha is pain in the body, and dukkha is death, and dukkha is like I said, I'll talk about it a little bit. But we want to talk about this big catastrophic way of feeling dis-ease or uncomfort or suffering. But dukkha can also be super subtle. It can be small. It can be little discrepancies in the mind. And there's this female Thai master, Ajahn Neb, and she says, any time that we move, like I'm watching you now, any time that we move, we're moving from discomfort. So that was probably, sorry to call you out, but that was probably you had an itch or something, right? So this was a movement to relieve the discomfort of the itch. When we blink, the subtleness of blinking to relieve the discomfort of dryness of the eye. When we're sitting in practice, even when we shift ourselves the slightest bit. I actually like to play with this a lot because if I think about every movement I make is a move from discomfort. That's pretty profound. I mean, I could stop the talk there and we could practice with that all day, really. I mean, we could totally work with that all day. Because that means that everything that we do, we're shifting away from something that we find unpleasant or not liking. So even going to the bathroom, we're going to the restroom, we don't like the full bladder. And how nice is it, like not to get super personal, but how nice is it to relieve the bladder? Like it feels so good. I mean, I've actually heard people go, in the bathroom. It's just like, it's what we do. So we're moving away from the discomfort. When we go to eat, it's because there's a discomfort of hunger in our belly. There's a dissatisfaction. Or if it's not hunger, maybe it's a dissatisfaction of lack or trying to fill or feed something, right? So if it's not actually hunger, we're trying to fill or feed something. So that reflection of every time we move, we're moving. So I guess if we weren't dissatisfied, maybe we would just never move. Like, is that, we would just be still all the time? Maybe. I don't know. Check it out. I'm a weirdo, so I check that kind of stuff out because it's just what I like to do. Even one night I felt I was laying down in bed and I was like, the end of a long day. Nothing could be better. Right? Nothing is better than the pillow, the comforter. Like, my bed is so comfortable. This is great. And literally within, 5 to 10 minutes, I was moving because I was uncomfortable. And so every time we just get in touch with, so dukkha, that's dukkha. I'm going to explain the three different types of dukkha, but the big dukkha that we often talk about or that we think about in this practice being birth is dukkha. Aging, we know, is dukkha. Death is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Association with the unbeloved is dukkha. Separation from the loved is dukkha. Not getting what is wanted is dukkha. In short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. So that's what it says in the Sanyutta Nikaya about dukkha. All of those things are dukkha. So that's the main one. The main one, number one, or the main one that we think about, the dukkha of pain in our physical body, our emotional body, and our mental body. One way of experiencing dukkha. Another way, and that one's called dukkha dukkha. It's got double dukkha. Dukkha squared, or wait, squared four times. Dukkha twice, whatever that is. And then the second dukkha is called viparyana dukkha. So viparyana dukkha is really dukkha due to change. So when anything that we really like goes away, you know that feeling? Something that we're enjoying that's really pleasurable goes away, that's viparyana dukkha. And then sankhara dukkha, and this one to me is the most cunning, sankhara dukkha. And a few of you brought it up today. Sankhara dukkha it's very subtle, or from my understanding of it, sankhara dukkha can be just boredom. It can be neutral, right? So you're not really hating it. So it's not the first, it's not dukkha dukkha. And you're not really loving it and worried that it's going to be away. So it's go away. So it's not viparyana dukkha. But it's more that neutral, not knowing where you are, that just that subtle dissatisfaction. You know when there's nothing going wrong in your life? Absolutely nothing, and everything's fine, yet there's still this subtle dissatisfaction. Does anybody have that other than me? Yeah. And it's really wild. And it's really uncomfortable. I kind of like it when I have something big to dig into. You know, that makes me actually feel more safe and comfortable because I have a reason for being uncomfortable. But when I don't have a reason for being uncomfortable, when it's just this low-grade neutral, boredom, nothing. For me, speak for myself, very, very painful. And I try to figure it out. And I'll never forget, this is one of those moments that I have, and his eyes are closed, so he doesn't know I'm going to talk about him right now. But I was on retreat at Spirit Rock, and I was talking to you about this earlier, how important interviews are. I was heartbroken. We'll just lay it out there. I was heartbroken and went into a retreat, and that really sucks. I'll just let you know if you haven't experienced it before. And I was about 5 or 6 days into the retreat, and I kind of like, okay, the heartbreak, I was sick of myself, you know, like I was over the replay and the what was me story. And, you know, I was sick of the twofer. Like, I didn't pay for that person to be on this cushion with me. So I felt like I was getting a two for one, you know, or they were getting a two for one. I was like, no, okay, you can't be here. I'm here. And so when I let that go a little bit, I started this, how can I make myself better? You know, so I started in this rumination of, okay, I'm feeling empty, I'm feeling lonely, I'm feeling bored. So when I'm bored, I start creating, right? Like the mind gets so creative. And I mean, I wrote a book once on retreat, a chapter. It was 8,500 words, but I still wrote a whole book chapter on retreat. And that's how creative we get, right? In our boredom. And so I was starting to make a whole life for myself, and all these interesting things were happening. And I went into Gil to tell him about it. And in literally, I feel like it was 5 minutes. He's like, that's conceit. Like, whoa, I was feeling so good about that storyline. That was great. And then he told me about this conceit, and the way that he described it, of course, was so gracious and beautiful. It was not harsh at all. But this way that we reach this choice point in our practice, in our lives, in our days, where when we hit something uncomfortable, right, we hit the discomfort. And right here, we have the choice to imagine ourselves, we have the choice to feel it first, usually the moment we bump into the discomfort of the feeling of it, that's where our choice point lies. Because if it's unpleasant, we want to get rid of it. If it's pleasant, we want to grab more. So for me, it was unpleasant. And so I wanted to create a reality that was going to make me feel better. I wanted to create a reality that was more pleasant. And so over and over again, I was creating this new becoming into being, right? And then the other option is to feel it, allow it, know that the direction that we're trying to take it might not always and doesn't always or usually doesn't end suffering, because the direction I wanted to take it was in my habitual direction of creating more suffering. So I'm gonna talk about that a little bit more in a moment, but I got a little off track, so I want to get back onto track. So how I have decided to break suffering in half, like what worked for me, was what can I control and what can't I control? It kind of broke down to that for me, right? And so I want to talk about the what can't I control first. And I have a really favorite teacher. Her name is Anushka, and some of you might know her. And she does this really cool thing, and I guess I'll just do it with this. I thought I brought a blank piece of paper in here. So some of the things, let's just throw out there things that we can't control, right? And I'm gonna throw some things out there, and I'm also going to ask you. So some of the things that I know I can't control are other people. I can't control how other people behave. I can't control how other people are going to feel about me. And there's probably, again, a few of you have probably had the twofers in here, the conversations with others, where we replay them over and over again in our mind, thinking that the outcome is going to change somehow. And that person's not even here, right? So we can't control others. We can't control the weather. Although it's kind of that's kind of a big topic, because when we talk on a grand scale and we think about climate change, right, there are definitely ways that we affect the weather. There are things we can do, and we know this, right? I don't need to get political right now. I'm sorry. But like yesterday, I was going to go and just walk around the property a little bit, and I felt some raindrops. And I said, okay, well, maybe I'm not going to walk today, you know, because there's raindrops. But I've also been on big vacations, and there's been rain, you know, storms, and then it's disturbing. But there's that way that we want to control the weather. We want to control the surf. Totally. A big one is aging. And that was one that I said about the sutta. We cannot control aging. And it's really remarkable to me. I mean, I read something about $6 billion spent in America on anti-aging things, creams, injections, liposuction, whatever, you know, anti-aging, $6 billion. So that's the fight against the inevitable. We're fighting against something. Okay, anyway, I could go on about that. We can't fight. I mean, we can't control what's going to be served for lunch. Somebody can. Michelle can. We can't. We can't control the past. How often? I mean, really, I think most of my retreat time has been spent ruminating about the past. And our minds are actually really trying to be our friends in that way. I feel like I have this little executive assistant that lives like next door to my brain, you know? And my little executive assistant is trying to figure it out for me. Like they're trying to manage my life for me so that the outcome can be better. And she's going back and seeing what we did wrong so that we cannot do it again. And, you know, there's this way that the executive assistant is there. And like I said, I think it's super friendly what this executive assistant is doing, but it actually isn't going to help. Like we can't, maybe we can learn and grow from the past, but we can't redo it, right? So that's something I can't control. And then I got, like I said, again, I'm a little dorky about this, but I was like, okay, what are some of the laws? Like, what are some of the, you know, because we're calling this the first noble truth. So when I hear the word truth, and this is T with a capital T, it's not T with a small t, right? So it's not like, well, my truth is like, I know what's true for me. You know, there's that kind of truth, right? I'm not bemoaning that, but I'm just saying, like, we have, like, I know my truth. There's that truth. But then there's the capital T truths. And the first noble truth is with a capital T in my mind, because it's not negotiable. You know, they're the things that just are. Old age, sickness, death, they just are. So I checked into some of the other truths or laws were, right? And so gravity is one of them. And so this is the little Anushka trick. Those of you with their eyes closed, you don't have to open them, but here I have a piece of paper. I'm a magician now. Here I have a piece of paper. And in my hand, I hold a piece of paper. One of the things we know about gravity is if that I turn my hand over and I open my hand, what's going to happen? It's going to fall, right? And so if I pick it up again, and if I pray really hard or hold my precepts really hard or do anything really well, like if I'm a really good person, I'm really kind, I do metta, whatever, if I turn my hand over, what's going to happen if I open it? It's going to fall. So that's a truth. Like, that's a law. And no matter what I do, no matter what action, no matter how I turn my insides in and out, no matter what my executive assistant does, that's still going to fall, right? No matter what. Relativity is like that. Time is like that. We can't take time back. Cause and effect is like that. Causality, polarity, and rhythm, and gestation. So those were some of the laws that I found that are like that. We can't do anything about it. So what can't I control? And when we know, there's like this ease in not having to control something. I've been called a control freak before. Go figure, like, go figure. But again, to be revealing, I went on a date the other day. And for the first time, mostly in my life, this guy was like, I'm going to make the plan. It's like, wow, really? That's totally cool. I don't have to make the plan. You're going to make the plan. And there was something about that, something about me knowing that I didn't have to control it, that set me at ease. And so that's how I feel about this first noble truth of suffering. If we can really understand impermanence, it's real. It's a truth. It happens, right? If we can really understand that we're going to age, that we're going to get sick, getting sick happens. The people that we love are going to die or are going to leave us. It happens. And this again is where I'm a little bit of a weirdo. Like, I like knowing that that's what's true. I don't have to guess about that. That is true. And then I also like knowing what I can control. Right? So that's what I can't control. And there's ease in that. It's not easy, because death isn't easy. Aging isn't easy. But how can we let ourselves say, oh, wow, that's interesting. This is just the way it is. And there's one department, there's one like jurisdiction that I don't have to handle. There's stuff I do have to handle, but that I don't. That's covered. So then, what can I control? And this to me, when, and we're going to start covering the Eightfold Path or I guess I am on Friday, this to me is where, when we're talking about the Four Noble Truths, this is where the Eightfold Path really comes into play. What can I control? I can really control how I act in the world. I can control how I speak to other people, how I behave. I can control my choices of what I do. And we really, on this retreat, where our jurisdiction lies, is what our mind is doing. Because we've really kind of, you know, created this place where you don't have to worry about your cars or gasoline or food or the emails or, you know, all of these really mundane, redundant things that take up so much time in our lives. You guys don't need to worry about that right now. You know, you're free of that. And that's beautiful. That's a beautiful thing. And so then what we get to come into contact with, maybe even harder than filling up our gas tank or making a meal, is these beautiful minds that we have. When Gil was giving his instructions this morning, you know, I was really fine with when we did the hands, I was right there. We did the breath, I was right there. But the second he got to noticing a strong sensation in my body, and earlier today I was having a lot of pain in my shoulders and in my neck. So the hands felt great, the breath felt great. My shoulders and neck didn't feel good. But what was an interesting thing is the second we got to that place, and I started to have to feel some pain or discomfort, my mind started going. I got very busy. It was like, escape route, escape route, escape route. You know, where can I go? We don't want to feel this. Where do I go? And so it's sort of interesting, you know, how avoidant we can be, how aversive we can be with this thing we call dukkha, which is actually meant to be a teaching to explore, to know, to not escape. One night a couple years ago, I am a bit of a news junkie. You know, I'll admit it. I read the news, I watch the news. I don't have a TV, but you know, we can watch it through the internet and all that. And I was noticing I was having just a lot of fear. A lot of fear was coming up in my life and my being. And like my jaw was tight, my shoulders were tight. I wasn't sleeping well. There was a lot of uneasiness in my life. And I have two children. I have, they're now 18 and 15. But when this happened, they were smaller. They were more vulnerable and, you know, less. I mean, I have an 18-year-old son who's 6'4". So now, the space has changed in my house. But I was laying in bed one night and a lot of fear was up for me because I grew up having a lot of violent images and things. I'm going to talk about that a little bit in the meta part of my talk. But I was laying there and I was having these things come up for me. And I wasn't feeling safe in my house at all. I have two big dogs. I have two big kids. I have all these reasons why safety is like, and I live in a nice neighborhood, and there was no reason not to feel unsafe, but I was feeling very unsafe. It was just there. There was no denying it. So I was laying there in my bed, and in the old days, again, being transparent, I used to have a rifle under my bed. Okay, that's who I used to be. We're talking 20 years ago. I used to be that person. And there were times that I would even sleep under my bed with my rifle. Like that's how unsafe I used to feel in my life. And tonight I was having those same sort of feelings of unsafety, or that night. Nowhere to go, nothing to do. You know that feeling of being afraid of the boogeyman? Like, so you can't close enough doors, you can't lock enough windows, there's nowhere to go. And I'm only telling the story not to freak you guys out, but it's sort of a retreat story. You know, it's like we find ourselves in our bodies, in our minds, and there's nowhere to go. And I did something which is a little weird because I'm not a woo-woo kind of person. You know, it's like, I was like, okay, I imagine the Buddha. And I imagine the Buddha sitting under a tree 2,600 years ago with snakes and tigers and bears and, you know, whatever were in northern India at the time. And just thinking like, dude, man, he had to feel unsafe. Like, you know, where can I find refuge? I just needed a refuge that wasn't actually real. I needed an internal refuge because there was no external refuge that was going to help my suffering, that was going to help my fear. And there was something that happened when I just sort of called on the historic Buddha, you know, and it makes me think of the first refuge, the refuge of the Buddha. I called on the historic Buddha just in that way. And I had this, you know, I had this cessation. The cessation happened. And it wasn't because nothing changed, but what happened was just an understanding that suffering is there. It's not there. And this delusion that we live under, that we don't have to suffer, is false. Vinny, who has the propensity for leaving poetry in strange places, I found a poem he probably left about 4 years ago in a book in my house. This is by Helen Keller. Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of men as a whole experience it. Avoiding danger is no safer in the long run than outright exposure. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. Thank you, Vinny. So here we are, right? On this daring adventure. It's a daring adventure. Ajahn Chah says there are two kinds of suffering, the suffering that leads to more suffering and the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. The suffering that leads to more suffering is when we fall into our habitual patterns of doing the same thing over and over again that causes pain. The suffering that leads to more suffering is believing. And again, I'm using the word suffering when I know earlier I said that translation is a little tricky, but it's what's used, so that's what I'm using. Suffering that leads to more suffering is the belief, is falling into the delusion, believing that certain things aren't going to happen and doing everything we can to avoid. The suffering that leads us out of suffering might feel harder in the moment. Making change is hard. So it feels like suffering when maybe we're not going to make the choice that we're habitually used to making. But ultimately, leads to a deeper level of happiness due to the renunciation of our unskillful actions. Does that make sense? What I'm saying? And there's just this way that we can be so loyal, and Gil touched on this last night, we can be so loyal to our suffering. There's this way that we so identify with it. It creates our being. And maybe it's cultural, you know, maybe we come from a culture where suffering is really righteous. Maybe it's familial, or maybe it's just a safety blanket. Maybe it makes us look cool. You know, maybe it's the only way we know how to be intimate with another person. Caroline Mace, who's a spiritual teacher that I really love, she talks about how people, when they meet each other's wounds. You know, they kind of like, my wound's meeting your wound, so let's hang out, you know? It's not like my wellness meets your wellness, so let's hang out. It's my wound meets your wound, so let's hang out. Let's tell stories about how bad we had it. And then, you know, and it's really interesting how we can tend to want to live in that place. And it gives us an excuse. Like, it gives us an excuse to behave badly in a way. My wounds gave me the excuse to behave really badly and to treat other people really badly. Well, it's like, can I say the F word in here? No. Fuck you. I said it. Edit. You know, I get to do this because it happened to me, right? So we get to perpetuate our suffering and make others suffer because we suffered, because our parents suffered, because our ancestors suffered. And, you know, we have this lineage of suffering. And what we're being taught in this teaching is, no, let's stop. Let's stop. We don't have a rearview mirror in this practice. Karma doesn't have a rearview mirror. I don't know where I heard that, but I heard it and I like it. I'm not sure who taught that. It's probably not in the suttas. But I like that idea that karma doesn't have a rearview mirror. It's like I get to keep moving forward in my actions and in my speech and in my thoughts. I don't have to keep becoming that which was. Okay, so you guys know about the second dart, right? Do I need to talk about that? I just want to read this one part and then I'm going to move on to metta. Because I think this is like just so right on. And this is what practice is doing for us. We are training our minds. So bringing it back into the practice realm, we are training our minds to be able to see where we allow ourselves to go and we allow ourselves not to go. Right? Like, where's the slippery slope? Where do I entertain myself into suffering? Where do I let myself be on bad behavior? And where do I change my route into skillful, wholesome behavior that's going to lead to growth, that's going to take me on the path to liberation? That's what we're looking at. So we have this. And so, having been touched by that painful feeling, he resists and resents it. I'll change pronouns and stuff while I go, so don't get confused. Then in her, whoso resists and resents that painful feeling, an underlying tendency of resistance against that painful feeling comes to underlie her mind. Under the impact of that painful feeling, they then proceed to enjoy sensual happiness. And why do they do so? An untaught worldling, O monks, does not know of any other escape from painful feelings except the enjoyment of sensual pleasures. So that way that when we're feeling uncomfortable, all the untrained mind knows how to do is to seek pleasure. Displeasure, seek pleasure. The trained mind knows that unpleasant is just unpleasant, can handle, can trust the experience of unpleasant. So one of my favorite riddles, I'm going to end suffering with this, is imagine you're stuck in a room with no windows and no doors. How do you get out? Does anybody know this? Imagine you're stuck in a room with no windows and no doors. How do you get out? Riddles are great. I love riddles. They're great for road trips. They can take you all the way to Yosemite from LA. Anybody? Yes. Did you know that or are you brilliant?
No.
She's right. So the answer to that is stop imagining. I love that. Imagine you're stuck in a room. Imagine you're stuck in a room with no windows and no doors. How do you get out? Stop imagining. So that's what the mind does. It just imagines itself into a window, a room with no windows and no doors. We can imagine ourselves out. Like, that's totally possible. So to lean in another direction, so one way that suffering, so what are we looking at here? We're looking at, we know that the first noble truth is dukkha, or this thing we call dukkha, and there's many different ways to describe dukkha, right? So again, I just want to remember that dukkha is not only this big suffering, but it's the subtleness of, even right now, like if you're just done with this talk, right? If you're just bored, if you're just ready to move, if you're ready to go, that's dukkha, and that's okay. It's totally okay, right? Like, we think that that's not okay, but it is. And like, I'm okay with you being bored with my talk. So you have to be okay with me, you being bored with my talk. I'm a little bored with my talk, but that's, you know, I have to be okay with me being bored with my talk. So there's just these little subtleties of what goes on constantly and how we maneuver our lives and our actions all the time around those subtleties, right? So we don't have to only think of dukkha as big. We don't only have to think of the First Noble Truth as big. And then the First Noble Truth doesn't end at the number one. It ends at the number four. And then there's eight after that. So there's many ways to not have to stay stuck. And we're going to talk about that over the next few days. But I just really wanted to dig into that first. And one of the things that I introduced, or one of the ways that I introduced last night, was this metta practice. And there were some people not here. So metta, and this is where sort of the mythology of Buddhism is so fun to tell and to talk about. The mythology of Buddha, or some of the stories of the Buddha and metta, is that there was this group of 500 monks, and I'm going to say nuns too, just because I want to, because we want some equality here. But I think it was probably just monks at the time. But we'll pretend. We're going on the rains retreats, which lasted for 3 to 4 months. And we are talking at the time of the Buddha. And so this one particular group of monks and nuns were being sent to the foothills of the Himalayas to go on this 3 to 4 month retreat. And so they, you know, I'm assuming packed up all their gear and walked on the mud paths and got to their spot. And they were really happy with their spot. It was apparently very beautiful. You know, they were under trees and there was a clear lake and it was just the perfect abiding place. There was a village very nearby so they could go on their alms rounds, and it was just kind of perfect. And they were going to stay there for a while and practice. So each of the 500 of them, I mean, imagine it's like a circus, like a rolling circus, really. Like, I'm trying to imagine 500 people showing up anywhere, but they did. And they settled under the trees, and apparently there was a bunch of tree deities there, these celestial beings that were living in these trees. And at first the celestial beings were like, oh, that's cool, they'll stay for a day or two, they're passing through, right? So they were fine with it. But as the days go by, they realized that they weren't leaving. And so they started, you know, talking amongst themselves and trying to figure out a plan on how to get rid of these probably very smelly by now guys in robes and shaved heads. And so they decided that they were going to plant visuals of violence in their brains, and that they were going to shoot stinky smells around, and they were going to make scary noises. And so, have you guys all heard this story? I feel like I'm used to telling bedtime stories. I'm like, okay, good. It's always fun when there's a punchline. When there's not, it's not as fun. So these deities decided, you know, they want to get rid of them. So they're going to try to do everything they could to get rid of them. And these monks are sitting there very sort of exposed to the elements. And, you know, imagine if you're sitting there and you're exposed and you don't have a hut, you don't have anything, you're sitting under the trees and there's noises and there's violent images and there's horrible smells. I know what I would do. It's like Airbnb, you know, where's the next one? So they all gathered, and the elders of them gathered, and they decided to go back to the Buddha and say, you know, this isn't working. Like, you need to find us a new spot. And so they went back and told him, and he apparently, with his supernatural powers, searched all over India and couldn't find a better spot. So he sent them back and said, you just have to practice there, but I'll send you back with some defense mechanisms. And what he sent them back with was the Metta Sutta. So what I read to you last night was what he sent them back with in this story. And so the whole way going back, they chanted the Metta Sutta, and they arrived to the forest with the Metta Sutta, sending love to all living beings in all four directions, far and wide, like a mother loves her only child, right? They're chanting this. So they're emitting, they're sending, they're meaning it. And so the forest, the tree deities hear this and they say, okay, well, we'll let them stay. So they ended up staying for their time and nobody was afraid anymore and everything was beautiful. So how, of course, I want to share that is as a metaphor for our minds, for the stressors and those dukkhas that come up for us, big or small. Right? When we give the permission, the allowance to stay, because it's beautiful, because it belongs there, it doesn't not belong there. When we can send it this, like I was talking about it last night, which is much easier, which is much more palpable for me, because I resisted metta for a really long time. For probably 4 or 5 years, I resisted metta. And the only reason I started doing metta is because a teacher gave it to me as an assignment. And I resisted it because I thought it was really like flowery and gushy and, you know, it was just like, really? Kind of like Gail was talking about last night. It wasn't for me. And I grew up Catholic and I was a Hindu for a while and I practice in the Native American church, and there was just all of these things that, like, for me didn't work about metta. It felt too prayery and stuff like that for me. So I avoided it until it was assigned to me. And then once it was assigned to me, I was still really incredibly resistant, and I realized why I was resistant. And maybe at some point in the retreat we can share this practice, but I didn't feel like I was deserving. Or I didn't feel like I deserved to be happy. I didn't feel like I deserved to be at peace and at ease or free, because I had caused a lot of harm to a lot of people. And I had caused a lot of harm to myself in my earlier years. And there was a way that I needed to come in contact with a forgiveness practice first, before I came into contact with the metta practice. There was another thing, though, that sold me on the metta practice. So Buddhaghosa, who is a sage 1,500 years after the Buddha, he wrote the Visuddhimagga, and he wrote 11 benefits of metta. And so I read this one day when I was like contemplating, like, am I really going to try this metta practice? So there's 11 benefits to metta. He sleeps in comfort. I really like that because I have insomnia. I was like, okay, I'm going to. That's a good reason. 2, she awakes in comfort. Well, if you sleep in comfort, you awake in comfort, right? Okay, I won't have little side notes. I'm just going to read them. Sorry. Okay, he sleeps in comfort. She awakes in comfort. They see no evil dreams. He is dear to human beings. She is dear to non-human beings. Devas and gods protect them. Fire, poison, and sword cannot touch them. Their mind can concentrate quickly. Their countenance is serene. There was also a little like side note. One's complexion is bright. I was like, I could dig on that. Like, they die without being confused in mind. If not yet enlightened, this is 11, if not yet enlightened, will return in a higher realm. So I wasn't really sold on the benefits of metta when they were sold to me in a flowery package. But when I read that list of 11, there was a lot of good reasons why to practice it. And I have to tell you, once I did start practicing metta, I did stop having nightmares. And I'm not this, okay, so this is like the woo-woo part, but it actually happened. Like I stopped having nightmares. That was wild to me. It took about 4 months, but every night I would say for 10 years I had a nightmare. And after practicing metta, they went away. I don't know what that means. I'm just saying. So it might have just been that I was focusing care and kindness and love and friendliness towards myself and others. Like maybe that was it. I hadn't really done that before. I'd done a lot of mindfulness. I'd done a lot of practice. But this focused, skillful, not wishful. It's not when I first heard it, may I be happy or may you be happy. May I be at peace at ease. May you be at peace at ease. I knew I couldn't, I wasn't casting spells. You know, it wasn't about making something happen. But what I realized was holding that sort of wish in my heart just opened my heart. That's all it needed to do. It didn't need to do anything more. I knew I couldn't actually change somebody's life or make something different. But I knew that if I held just merely the thought in my heart and my mind, in Buddhism, we call it citta, right? So heart and mind aren't separate. Heart, mind, same thing, citta. I knew if I held the wish, the hope in my heart and mind, there was just something that it did. It opened something. It made me a lot more tolerant towards other people. It made me a lot more tolerant towards myself. And it wasn't even anything I had to try to do. It just happened. So I'm going to encourage anybody who doesn't have a metta practice or is resistant to it to keep at it, like to let it just do what it does without trying. And if it needs a forgiveness practice first, which mine did, then, you know, maybe we can talk about that. So there's this poem that I really love, and I think it's really fitting for right now. It was written in probably this early 1700s by Françoise Fendant. And it's, as light increases, we see ourselves to be worse than we thought. We are amazed at our former blindness, as we see issuing forth from the depths of our heart a whole swarm of shameful thought and feelings. We could never have believed that we had harbored such things, and we stand aghast as we watch them gradually appear. But we must neither be amazed nor disheartened. We are not worse than we were. On the contrary, we are better. But while our faults diminish, the light by which we see them waxes brighter, and we are filled with horror. Bear in mind for your comfort that we only perceive our malady when the cure begins. So have no fear of this dukkha that you may be experiencing. Have no fear. We only perceive our malady when the cure begins. I mean, that's so beautiful. We can't do anything about it until we see it. We can't do anything about it until we sit and are willing and courageous enough to let it show itself. And then we have these practices to hold these maladies, to hold this dukkha. We have this compassion, we have this metta, to hold it when it shows itself. It's a celebration when it shows itself. It's not something to run from. This is good. So let's just sit for a minute.